Welcome to the Writer's Weekly Podcast, a forum geared toward the writing enthusiast and those who want to make money from their writing. I'm Brian Whidden, Managing Editor of Writer's Weekly, and I'll be your host along with Angela Hoy, the creator of Writer's Weekly and President and CEO of BookLocker.com, a full-service book publishing company. Whether you want to learn how to become a professional writer, how to find writing gigs, or even publish your own book, then you come to the right place. We'll be discussing all kinds of topics relating to the writing and publishing industries. Don't forget, you can also click over to writersweekly.com. There, you'll find not only thousands of articles about professional writing, you can also find current paying markets and job listings to help you boost your writing career and even your bottom line. But for now, let's get on to this episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. And hello again. Welcome to another episode of the Writers Weekly Podcast. We've hit a little bit of a milestone. This is episode number 10. I know that's kind of peanuts in the world of podcasting. But to be honest, when we got started with this, we weren't even sure we were going to make it to 10 episodes. So today I wanted to do something a little special. You probably assume that most publishing companies are created by big time fat cats who are looking for another way to make some major money. And oftentimes that's true, but there are exceptions. People who get into this business because they're truly passionate about literature and just want to do something that involves their love for books and the written word. And then there's another one that has a far more unique story. And in this, our 10th episode, I wanted to share a story with you that tells of somebody who started out as just a regular person and became somewhat of an unsung hero in the publishing industry. In fact, it wouldn't be a stretch at all to call her a quiet lioness in a sometimes untamed world of the literary business. To know her today, it's hard to imagine the formidable and challenging background she's come from. She can be a hard ass, but that's because she's had to claw and fight for every success she's ever achieved. I can personally attest from the last 10 years of knowing her, nothing, and I repeat, nothing has come easy for her. But this isn't just a story about one person's success. I believe it's a story we should all hear because we all find ourselves in deep, dark places in life where the only way out seems almost too far and too difficult to reach. Sometimes we can't even see it. And at times like these, the only way out is to take one small step, get our footing, and then take the next small step. And every time we see a root, a branch, even a twig that might help us pull ourselves out another inch closer to the daylight, we grab it, we take a risk, we pray to God that it holds while we look for the next thing to grab onto. And this is a story of what it takes to succeed. We can all do it if we're willing to put in the effort, take the risks, acknowledge our fears while refusing to let them defeat us, and endure the discomfort of striving for something. It's also a story of how successful you can become by striving to serve others. Because I also know from the past 10 years that this person doesn't do all this for herself. She's always done it for others. You can almost say that success was a byproduct of her service to others. I'm talking about none other than Angela Hoy, creator of Writers Weekly, president, CEO, and chief bottle washer of BookLocker.com, and she's right here with me right now.
That was really sweet. A lot of wisdom in there and some very sweet words. I had no idea you were going
to
say that.
Well, that's why really I didn't send you that copy, because you probably told me not to do this.
I would have.
And you're probably going to try to tell me to edit this out, but I'm not going to. So
I don't know how to use your editing program, but yeah, that was very sweet. Thank you.
Well, welcome back to our little basement recording studio here. And if y'all haven't figured it out by now, that intro should have clinched it for you. I have a little bit of a flair for the dramatic. But it's not over-exaggerated here. Book Locker and Writers Weekly came, from troubled times, and we're gonna talk talk about that. But that's not all we're going to talk about. We're basically going to explain the history of both these businesses and the uniqueness of the person that built them here. So, Angie, what you've done is something that very few people in this world are able to accomplish. And I wanted people to hear what went into building what you have and how it all started. People read Writer's Weekly for free. They publish their books with BookLocker, and they come to you with for advice. But most don't really comprehend all that you've done for writers and authors or what it's cost you. And so let's start back before there was even a twinkling of a publishing career in your life. Tell us a little bit about your growing up.
Well, I always liked to write stories. And when I was a teenager, I would... I would write stories about my friends, me and my friends, and make them really funny. And I would illustrate them, and I'm a horrible illustrator. And
I've seen one of your drawings.
I'll post a link to that. Actually, I know which you one did, you're talking
you did,
about.
You did post that in Writer's Weekly, yeah, right. So I'm not talking out of school here. Yeah.
My dear friend Grazia, who I was in high school with, she told me not long ago that she remembers one of the books that I created. It was a storybook of me and my friends and her. And I just made them funny as heck. And I would just fold the paper and tape it all together, just make these little funny booklets, and, you know, and everybody would laugh.
Did you think back then that you were going to be a professional writer? Did you think you'd be publishing books? Did you, I mean, was this just a hobby? What was your...
No, I actually wanted to be a psychologist. I actually went to school to major in psychology.
Thank God she became a publisher.
Right, okay. Right? Because you would never win an argument. I got disillusioned with psychology because it didn't really sync with my Christian religion. And so I bolted out of that. So
you've always told me about how you had a flair for making money, even as a kid. Tell me about some of the ways you made money as a kid.
Okay, I had I had a pet mouse. I think I bought her at the pet store, and she was ginormously pregnant. And when she weaned her babies, I took them to school in my pockets, and I sold them to my friends. I got caught. Mr. Clayton was our principal, and I begged him not to call my parents, and he did. I would buy candy bars from the drugstore and sell them for 10 times as much at school, because, you know, you couldn't get candy bars at school back then. I was always looking for a way to make an extra dollar.
Now you did tell me that you were kind of a smart ass in school, and that got you in trouble from time to time, but you recently told me about a teacher that was very special to you, and you have recently reconnected with her?
No. Okay, there were two teachers. Okay. Mrs. Martin was my English teacher, 10th grade English teacher in high school.
Okay.
And we had required reading, a book we had to read. I didn't want to read it, so I didn't. I wrote a report on it, and she gave me an A+ and wrote great BS on the paper. Then she really encouraged me, gave me all the extra credit projects that I wanted. I think I graduated from that class with like a 400% average, because everything that she assigned to me was fun. There was one thing, I don't think I've ever told you about this. There used to be this like psychology test where a person would answer like 10 questions, and then you could read what
they'd tell you what you should do for a living based on that.
Or what kind of personality you have. So I only remember one of the questions, and it was, you're walking in the forest and you see a coffee cup, describe it. And so it was these random questions. So some people would say it's a broken coffee cup. Somebody would say it's a metal coffee cup, like from the military. One of them said, it said world's best dad or something on them. Some people, you know, describe these like really intricate coffee cups. Anyway, so my English teacher, Mrs. Martin, let me do this personality test to the whole class. And they all wrote their answers down. And I took them all home, and over the weekend, I explained exactly what their personalities were like based on their answers. She gave me so many extra points for that, and it was fun. Now, I can tell you that it was pretty much more BS, but it was very entertaining. I'm pretty sure I didn't predict anybody's future, but I loved doing that.
Yeah.
It was creative writing. I just had this little hook for each question, for each person. I knew who they were, and I just started writing about them. Everybody loved it. It was great. The second teacher, Karen Collins. She is friends with me on Facebook. She belongs to Authors Safe Harbor on Facebook, our group. She and I reconnected a few years ago. She was my journalism teacher in high school.
Journalism. Okay, that was it.
She was the coolest chick, still is. Mm. She is an awesome lady. It was like going to high school with one of your friends. Mm. But she made you want to work. She made you want to do a good job. And she takes sole credit for me offering professional editing services to this day. Because she gave us extra credit for finding typos in the newspaper and magazines. And I wrote about this not too long ago on Facebook. My dad would come home from work to read the newspaper, the Houston Chronicle, and there would be holes all in the pages because I'd already come home from school and read the whole paper and cut out all the typos to take them to Miss Collins to get my extra credit. I also think I graduated from that class with a 400% average.
Wow.
But she turned editing into a game.
Yeah.
You know, so, and again, super cool chick. Really, really like her.
All right, so we're going to jump.
Oh, Mrs. Martin's deceased.
Oh, okay.
I looked for her about 10 years ago. She died. So
I knew one of these you had actually gotten to talk to on your new Facebook group, and we'll talk about that in a little bit.
Okay.
Okay, so let's jump to what, about the late 90s?
Yeah.
You were married at the time.
Mm-hmm. I got married when I was 19.
Got married when you're 19.
Yeah.
And
that was a mistake.
So you told me. Yeah, I know. Well, I know all the details about your first marriage. I'm going to let you gauge how much to tell, but I know that it was not an easy marriage for you.
Well, I was married for, I think, 12 and a half years. We had three kids. If you want to read the nitty gritty, extremely dirty details, the emergency divorce handbook for women, we have it on BookLocker, but you have to search for the words Angela's book, not the emergency divorce handbook for women, though it does pop up on Amazon that way. The reason that we made it that way was if women buy the book and their husband's in their computer and they see a receipt for that book, they won't see the name of that book.
Gotcha.
So we did that to protect women. From day one, I have offered that ebook for free to any woman who needs it or wants it. So anybody, go to writersweekly.com, click on the contact us at the top. If you want a free copy, send me your email address. I'll send it to you.
To put things, I think, in sterilized way, you were more or less the primary breadwinner of that relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You had three kids.
Yeah. I could hold down a job.
Like I said, I'm going to let you decide how much you're going to say and not say. So now did you write that emergency divorce handbook during this marriage or after your divorce?
Oh, no, after I got divorced.
Okay.
Yeah.
What kind of things did you have to do to make extra money? Because your income and his lack of income apparently did not make all the ends meet. So what other things did you do to earn extra money?
Oh, he had a few jobs, some income.
You told me,
but it was very unstable.
Yeah.
Well, let's see. I had a computer back before everybody had a computer, and I would type term papers for college students. I had some business cards printed and went and put them on we had a local community college and went and put them on the bulletin boards. And I had several college students, they'd pay me to put they would give me a handwritten term paper and I would, you know, type it and print it off for them and they would, you know, drop it off and pick it up.
Mm-hmm.
That was one thing I did for extra money. At one point in time, I was growing and selling bonsai plants from my backyard.
That's something not everybody does.
That didn't work out too well. I think I sold one. I grew a bunch.
Is that why you don't help me in the garden much?
Well, there's that. Our son Frank, Frank, he still likes bonsai trees to this day.
Wow. So, and he was very young at that time.
He was very young. Yeah. He was a toddler. I made marketing signs for some companies. Again, I'm a horrible artist, but I made it work. Didn't get much doing that. What did do well for me was I can't remember how I got the jobs or where I met these people. This is 30 years ago. I was doing accounting work freelance for two entrepreneurs who worked out of their homes.
Okay.
So when I was working for the aerospace company, we had Fridays off. We worked 4/10s. And every Friday I would go. His name was Roger. He was a wealthy entrepreneur, semi-retired. He was building his own airplane. Fun fact, when he flew the first time, he crashed it, but he survived. I would go and do his bookkeeping and pet his ferret. He had a pet ferret.
A
pet parrot, yeah. Super nice guy. Really professional, nice guy. Yeah. And the other guy, he had an active business going on, and he had employees, but he hired me to do his bookkeeping on the weekends, too. And I was writing articles for magazines and selling those.
What kind of articles were you writing?
Nonfiction.
Just nonfiction stuff? Okay.
Whatever, honestly, if I read the writer's guidelines for a magazine, and we'll get into this in a minute, if it was something I knew anything about, I would throw it out there and try to make extra money. Also, for a very short period of time,
and grabbing at those branches.
Yeah, I had a syndicated article for Fish and Game and Texas Fish and
You told me about that. Yeah, something about Texas Fish and Game. Yeah,
it's not the exact name of it. So they had me writing articles for their monthly newsletter. They never paid me.
Great.
Never got paid.
State agency.
Yeah. I went to Costa Rica for a week or so. I was 30 years old with my first husband, mm-hmm. and had an adventure, almost drowned. We'll save that for another podcast. Seriously, almost drowned on that trip. Caught a huge rooster fish, took some amazing pictures, got lost in the jungle. It was great. It was awesome. I sold my article to Sailing Magazine, I think. I mean, the big one.
Mm-hmm.
Never got paid. And that contributed to my future of going after magazines that weren't paying their writers. Mm-hmm. So,
you've told me often about your life with you, your husband, and your firstborn on Galveston Bay. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
We lived in a little, what we called a bungalow. I think it was about 400 square feet, one bathroom. The kitchen and living room were one room, and there were two very small bedrooms. And we could walk out to the bay, and we kept a crab trap out there, and we would catch crab, free food. Hey, man, that's the best free food.
Yeah.
And we would fish, free food, because we were making very little money back then. Yeah.
So you actually fished and caught crabs in order to be mm-hmm. able to eat.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Free food. Yeah.
Yeah, free food. Yeah. Well, and I like to fish for free food too, but I don't have to.
Right.
But apparently back then you actually were kind of forced to supplement your grocery bill.
Oh, sure. Know? Yeah.
So let's put that on the back burner then, and let's talk about, because all this stuff kind of intersects or overlaps. There you go. That's what I'm trying to think of. What was the precursor event that led to the creation of Writers Weekly?
I was working for an aerospace company. The previous company I worked for had gone out of business. I was working for an aerospace company in their accounting department again. And I was still writing for magazines on the side. And then I got offered a job by an internet marketing agency, and again, I'm still writing for magazines. Every year I bought a copy of the book called Writer's Market, which is published, used to be published by Writer's Digest Books. I don't think they sell it anymore. And, you know, I had a computer at the time, a pretty basic one. And most of, at that point, more and more listings had email addresses in them rather than just, because back in the day I was mailing letters, you know, to magazines. And those are called query letters when you're trying to get somebody to hire you to write an article. So, you know, I remember it was like February of that year, and it was the year that that book was dated, and I was sitting on my computer, and I'd sent out a bunch of queries in January, and, you know, I'm just checking my email every day. Somebody hire me, I need more money. And, because by that time I had three kids.
Okay.
And I started getting emails back. That editor who left here a year ago. Oh, I've been here a long time. I don't even know who that editor is. And I started realizing, and that book was expensive. Mm. It was big, but, you know, it was worth, if I could get a couple writing jobs, I would pay for it.
So let me stop you there. I just wanted to make sure we're clear. So in order to get leads on these writing jobs to write articles for magazines, you would buy what, yearly?
Yeah.
Monthly?
It's an annual book.
Yearly, a big, thick book. Mm-hmm. Full of all these periodicals, magazines, publications that were offering freelance writing jobs. And that's how you found them back then.
Right.
And when you would submit your queries to these places, you were getting responses back that basically those jobs no longer existed and maybe didn't exist for up to a year.
Right.
And in fact, even the people that were posting those jobs weren't even with the companies anymore.
Right.
And there was no way for people to know when these things were happening. There was no way to keep current on that stuff.
Well, Writer's Digest Books was the company that was publishing the book. They would, you know, send out these questionnaires to these companies every mm-hmm. year. Now, let's say you start sending them out in January, you get a bunch back in February, but the book doesn't get published for another 10 months.
Yeah.
By then, yeah. Who knows what percentage of the information in that book is completely irrelevant by that time.
And this is important for the listeners to understand what your next step was mm-hmm. and how you took something and basically figured out a way to make it better. So what did you do, you know, when you realized this was the situation?
Well, I was upset, you know, that book cost so much money. And so I decided, you know what? I can do better. I can create a website. How hard can it be? This is back when I taught myself HTML.
Yeah. When you said you were working for an internet marketing company, you were in the accounting office. You weren't an internet guru. You weren't one of these programmers making all kinds of money. Okay. So you taught yourself. I did too. HTML for mm-hmm. dummies.
Yeah.
So you taught yourself HTML. Okay.
Yep. And I created a pretty basic website. And it was called writersmarkets.com. Mm-hmm. And later it was changed to Writers Weekly. And
yeah,
we'll
but right now
that.
It was right. Writers Markets.
Writersmarkets.com, yep. Which said it all. And I started sending, I created a questionnaire to send to magazines, even websites, and said, you know, we're going to run this for you for free. And you can tell people how to subscribe, whatever, market yourself however way you want. But I want to know what you want for writers right now. And boy, I got a huge response. And I just started adding them to my little website, one after the other. Then I realized, and I was going online and promoting my writing website to others, to other writers. Oh, let's see. You've got mail. What was it? AOL?
AOL.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So I was going into these online writing groups, and I was keeping track of people who wanted to subscribe. This is long before people put subscribe buttons on their website. I would tell people, hey, if you want me to contact you every week with my new listings, send me an email. And I kept all those email addresses on a spreadsheet. I probably still have that somewhere.
And you would have to copy those emails and paste them into an email that you were about to send out for, right?
As I recall back then, my email program did allow me to copy and paste all of them at the same time.
Yeah, but you still had to go to that spreadsheet, copy them all down.
Oh, yeah, then, right. Yeah, or did I upload that? I can't remember. Again, we're talking 30-something years
ago. And I want to point out that to this day, 20-something mm-hmm. years later, every week we still mm-hmm. update our listing of what we call paying...
We, We post new paying markets for writers. Four ones every week, yeah.
And we don't charge the advertisers for this at all. We don't charge writers for anything. We just put them up there, and it's up to you. You can query these companies that we promote.
There's no advertising. There's no advertisers. You said...
Did I say advertisers?
Yeah.
They're not advertising.
Magazines and websites.
People
publishers.
That we said, hey, do you want to put something in our website? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. For free.
We have never once accepted any paid advertising on Writers Weekly whatsoever.
Yeah.
The website has always been free. You don't have to subscribe to see anything. You can see the entire website without subscribing at all. Everything is completely open and great. So...
Okay, so you would email these updated listings to all these people on this email list. So go from there.
And, that grew and grew. And then I started getting emails. I was also writing books on the side about how to be a freelance writer, how to be a syndicated newspaper columnist, because I did have one syndicated column, and I did a lot of research. And I was writing these little booklets and printing them, landscape, you know, two pages side by side, taking them to, I always say Kinko's, but it was Minuteman Press at the time. Yeah, every week, printing a few copies, stapling them, and put ads on my website. If you want this booklet, you know, send me, you know, this much plus shipping.
And not everybody had computers then either.
Not only that, I didn't have a merchant account back then. People had to mail me checks.
Oh,
there was no PayPal. Yeah, I didn't get, of course, getting a merchant account. But I used to go to the bank and just deposit all these checks at one time. Those were really taking off. Those books were doing really well. And then while I'm doing this, you know, really.
You were getting good.
Basic self-publishing. I mean, really basic, but it was working. I started getting emails from writers asking for my advice about all kinds of things. And one of them was, one of the most common one was, hey, such and such magazine owes me money. Can you help me get paid? Okay. That was something I really got into. I took the power of the pen, power of the website, and I would contact the magazines and say, we've been forwarded a complaint by your writer so-and-so saying you owe them this much money, and we want to know when you're going to be sending that check out because we're going to be featuring you on my website. Under our whispers and warnings section, we were able to help writers. I couldn't even tell you. I think with all we've done over the years, well over $1 million that we've been able
recovered
to get. Recover for writers. Never charged a penny to do it. I just did it because it was fun.
And this was kind of the precursor of your later on passion about chasing down scammers, which we're neck deep in now.
Right.
So that's a good a good news story, but all the news wasn't good. Apparently you got a little threat to be sued.
I know that,
by a company.
I know you hate it when I go backwards like this. When I created that website and put the markets on it, it was the only way that writers could get each publication's current needs.
Yeah.
I mean, within an hour. And it was the only source of that on the internet at the time. So, okay. What was your other question?
That's it. Okay. A magazine called Writer's Digest Magazine threatened to sue you.
Okay. Writer's Digest Magazine was also published by Writer's Digest Books.
Okay.
I was sitting at home one day and my phone rang. And it was a lawyer. He said he represented Writer's Digest Books or whatever the name of the company was back then. And he said, your website, writersmarkets.com, is infringing on our trademark. We need you to hand over ownership of that website to us.
And what happened?
Well, first I'm like, I've spent so much time building up this website. These are my subscribers. It's my website. I don't care if you don't like the name or not. And writer's markets was a common term.
Well, yeah, that's and Writer's Digest, Writer's Markets, two completely different names. So
right.
I don't know where they get off saying you're infringing on their trademark.
The name of the big book every year was Writer's Market.
Oh, and they were the ones that was publishing that
one.
Okay. Okay, so you just so you stuck an S at the end.
Yep. So he like I the gall of him to say you need to hand over your website because the website was doing very well.
It was doing better than
what they knew that.
Yeah.
And I said to him, I said, this just we're jumping ahead a little bit. I said to him, "Do you know who you're talking to?" He said, "No." I said, "You're talking to a single mother of three who's getting no child support. Sue me." Never heard from him again.
Yeah.
We did then change the name of the website to writersweekly.com. However, if you type in writersmarkets.com, it redirects to writersweekly.com. I still own it.
Have you ever gone back and looked at it to see if it's like still, is anyone still hosting it?
No, we still own writersmarkets.com.
Oh, in other words,
it redirects to writersweekly.com.
Okay.
Yeah. All so, right. yeah, I still
so
own it.
So they were never able to take that name away from you.
I won. Boy, I enjoyed that conversation. That was a lot of fun.
Okay. So three kids, single, doing all this stuff on the side to make mm-hmm. extra money. What was your primary source of income at this time?
My job.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was with the internet marketing company, I believe.
Right. Okay. And then I was earning extra money through my little website. I would come home from work, you know, feed the kids, get them ready for bed, help them with their homework, read them stories, tuck them in, everything, because I was divorced by this time. And then I would stay up half the night working on my little website.
Tell me a little bit about what life was like for you as a single parent trying to raise three kids and make ends meet this way.
That was rough. My ex only ever paid me one half of one child support payment. We got divorced in November. I got half of a payment, and I never got another dime. Many years later, he ended up giving up his parental rights, and he owed me, if I recall at the time, because we had a lawyer. If I recall,
you didn't even have to fight him for that.
No, because he didn't want to have to pay the $30,000 he owed me at that point. It was more than $30,000 that he owed me in child support. He was supposed to be help paying for their insurance and everything. So he just, yeah. And honestly, we were all better off that way. But I'm only earning my paycheck. I've got a mortgage payment. I've got utilities. I've got three kids. They were five, six, and 10 at the time. I think so. Yeah. And then things started going bad. The refrigerator broke. Couldn't afford to fix it. So I was giving the kids, you know, canned meals. And it was refrigerator freezers. I didn't have a freezer either. Mm. In the morning. Oh, they love when I bring this up during holidays. I would fix them cereal with powdered milk, and it was room temperature. Hey, they were eating.
I recall once you... I'm a Pop-Tart freak. I love Pop-Tarts, mm-hmm. but you refuse to eat Pop-Tarts. And one time you told me why.
Because they were cheap and I subsisted on Pop-Tarts for a long time. I was cooking meals for my kids. I would make them eat as much as, you know, you could make a kid eat. And I would eat, this sounds bad, but it's absolutely true. I would eat what was left over on my kids' plates because I didn't want to take food out of their mouths. And if they clean their plates, I would eat like half a Pop-Tart. And tell you what, it was a great diet. I looked awesome. But
you do that for your
kids.
Yeah.
And I never applied for food stamps because I was too proud. Mm-hmm. I never got help from the government at all.
So let's go to things got worse than a broken refrigerator. You lost your
job. Yep. Single
you,
mother.
You find yourself now jobless.
Yeah.
So tell me where does your mind go at that point?
I need to do whatever I can to make a lot of money right now.
Okay.
Because, literally penniless at that point, and try and take care of my kids, but too proud to take help from anybody. I'm just not that kind of person.
So what decisions did you make?
Well, I had been making those little booklets, and then one day I thought, you know, it'd be so much easier if I could just email people the Microsoft Word file of the book. They get it instantly. By this time I did have my own merchant account. They get it instantly. I get paid a lot faster, And I don't have to keep going to Minuteman Press and printing and stapling stuff. So
it was probably cheaper than you having to pay to print
absolutely.
Things out and staple them.
I was making more of a net profit doing it that way. So I'd been doing that for a few weeks or whatever. And that was working out really well. And like the weekend after I lost my job, I went, huh. And this was around the time that ebook became a known word in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And this, okay, this is going to be what year? 1998 or 1999. I started selling, you know, the Microsoft Word files, and then I lost my job. And then, you know, it was the weekend and I went, huh, what I've been selling are ebooks. Okay, they're Microsoft Word files, but they're electronic books.
Yeah.
I sat down for an entire weekend, put the kids in front of cartoons, and in one weekend, I wrote the book called How to Write, Publish, and Sell Ebooks. I put it on my website for sale on Monday, and the first day it was up for sale, I made more than $700.
That's better than most people do.
That was I mean, again, I was living on a shoestring. That was like half the money I needed to survive for the month. And that worked, and it kept selling.
Would it be fair to say that lit a fire under your butt?
Oh, yeah. Then I'm like, what should I write about next?
Yeah.
And I did. Yeah. I've published, I think, 26 books now. Yeah.
So that ebook that you wrote, you found because at this point now, single mom, Writers Weekly, and you're putting together ebooks is what's now starting to pay your bills.
Right.
And you had that ebook start being published from a publisher. Who did you go with?
I found a website where you could list your ebook for sale, and it was called booklocker.com. The owner's name was Sean. It was a little bitty website. Immediately, my book, How to Write, Publish, and Sell Ebooks, became the number one bestseller on his website. And he had the bestsellers, you know, on the mm-hmm. website, and then sold even more and more copies. And it wasn't much longer after that. By the way, this is around the time I got remarried.
I was going to say that at this point you are remarried.
Yes. So I lost my job and created this ebook about ebooks, and it sold like crazy. I was dating a guy on the side. A few months later, we got married mm-hmm. and moved from Texas to Massachusetts.
And this is why your last name is Hoy.
Right. We'll go into that later.
You've kept that because for business purposes, because that's what everybody knows you as.
Right.
But that's how that's how you get that last name.
So, and I want to add that my second husband, he and I still have a great relationship. Mm-hmm. We were married for a very long time. He's a great dad. He was a good husband. Yeah. We just, you know, we hit that midlife crisis thing and we realized, you know, we were going in two different directions. You know, he wanted to do a bunch of traveling. I'd already done so much traveling. I just kind of want to be a homebody from now on. We just went in different directions, but we still get along great. We talk every single day.
Yep.
And he's a great dad. He's a great grandpa, and we're still great friends. So there's no animosity there. He started his own marketing company.
Mm-hmm.
I'll post a link to it under this episode.
Mm-hmm.
He does book marketing, category keyword searches on Amazon to tell you exactly which ones to use. He also has a consulting service where he helps websites become successful. So I kept going with BookLocker. He started doing his own thing, but we still intersect all the time.
Sure.
Because most of our authors use his Boosted Book service.
Well, we actually refer several of our authors to his services.
Yeah, boostedbook.com. So he and I are now married, and I'm selling my ebook, and I find this ebook website, booklocker.com, and became the number one bestseller on their website. And it wasn't very long. I want to say a month, maybe. The owner...
Well, that's not long at all. I thought you were like on there for a few years or
something
before it came to
this. Okay. I'm talking weeks to months.
Okay.
I was in close contact with the owner, Sean, because, well, I was his number one bestseller. And he was a work-at-home dad, and from what I understand... he was spent a lot of time online, and he was just overwhelmed, and he offered to sell me booklocker.com, snatched it up for $5,000.
And that's how you became the owner, president, CEO of booklocker.com. So mm-hmm. now you've got two websites that you run. And, so what happens there?
Well, it was only selling ebooks, and now I can say we were only selling ebooks mm-hmm. at the time. And around this time is when print on demand started ramping up. And print on demand is simply a term for you print a book when it's purchased. You don't print a bunch
20,
of books.
30, put them in a box and ship them off to the book store.
Right.
Somebody can order one book. They print yeah. one book. They ship one book.
And there's yeah. no need for an author to buy, you know, 100 copies to keep in their basement. There's yeah. no need for publishers to warehouse books anymore. It's, you know, I can't even imagine how many trees have been saved. From
it was a revolutionary
idea. Yeah, very revolutionary. Yeah. And with print-on-demand books, if you hold a print-on-demand book next to one that was printed on a traditional press, you'll never know the difference.
And that's pretty much every book you're buying from Amazon today is going to be a print-on-demand for the most part.
Yeah, a lot of the traditional publishers now use print-on-demand technology yeah. also. So we started doing business with the largest book distributor in the world who had a print-on-demand division, and we contracted with them to start printing our books. And you know, we were putting them on our website. Oh, we were offering cover design, interior formatting. Oh, by this time, I've got employees, okay, and some contractors. It just really, really grew faster than you can imagine. And we were one of the first to offer all those services. And, of course, I already had a name in the industry through writersweekly.com, and we just started running ads for BookLocker. Not paid ads. We've never had paid advertising. But, you know, we would mix and match the companies and promote each other. And
I think NPR had something to do with your growth.
Oh, yeah.
Angie likes to, as soon as I ask, we actually have bullet-pointed scripts. We don't write all this out, read it word for word, but we have bullet points of what we're supposed to talk to. Problem is, when I ask Angie any question, she will put that piece of paper down and just go. And I have to reel her back in and tell her which bullet point we're on next. So, NPR.
Well, BookLocker was doing so well and was so popular, and so was Writers Weekly, that I got a call from NPR, National Public Radio, and they wanted to interview me about the print-on-demand industry and the future of book publishing. Mm-hmm. And for years, because they put that interview online, for years, we would get submissions to BookLocker. How did you hear about us? NPR, NPR, NPR. We were also in Oprah magazine. And that
Oprah
was also
wrote about you. Not, wow.
I'm sure it wasn't Oprah.
Oh, okay.
It was probably somebody that saw Oprah magazine on Writers Weekly and wrote. Just kidding. It wasn't anybody I knew. But that article was also put online. And for years and years, I'm talking 15 something years, people would say Oprah magazine. That's how I heard about
wow.
you. But NPR was huge. That was
and
that, huge.
That's when things started to explode, and you had to get employees and contractors to handle the work that was coming in.
Because then we were getting more and more press.
Yeah.
More and more authors wanted to hear about this, and the media was talking about it. Because it, you know, for back since Gutenberg, there's been a printing press, and mm-hmm. now all of a sudden, the entire industry changes.
Yeah.
And we were on top of it.
That's the thing is during that time, everything shifted from to digital everything.
Digital everything.
You know, you weren't mailing in a typewritten manuscript anymore. You were emailing in a Word document. Mm-hmm. You weren't shipping that manuscript to a printer who had to then basically copy it every time that they were printing books. You sent them a cover file and a interior text file, and they just download that into their computer. And anytime they want to print a book, they just say, bring up this, and boom, it comes out. So the whole industry was changing.
Well, back at that with time. The printing press, you know, they would actually use these blocked letters with ink, and they would set up each page.
Yeah.
Yeah, typesetting.
Yeah.
And now it was upload it, print yeah. on digital printers. Yeah. Bind it, cut it,
click,
send it out.
Click something with a mouse and out comes a book.
It was
yeah.
just a massive, massive shift in the industry. And yeah. we were on
you
top
were
right of
the
whole thing.
Spearhead.
We were right on the front lines of it. So yeah. it was great.
So so it sounds like, you know, you live happily ever after. But the thing is, even with all that success, there come challenges. Mm-hmm. So let's talk about the challenges that you've faced since BookLocker became since you picked up BookLocker and started running a publishing business out of a whim, basically.
It's true. Well, it was an emergency situation at the time. Uh-huh. Well, of course, we've had to keep up with the industry. Mm-hmm. Anybody who knows me knows that I hate learning new software, but I keep having to do it.
You should keep doing it.
Yeah, I do what has to be done. I think I mentioned InDesign in another episode.
Yeah.
Had to hire Charlene to do InDesign because, man, I met my match on that one. we didn't really have to keep up with our competitors. You know, more and more emerged over the years. And we learned that, you know, if a new one popped up, chances are they'd be out of business in 3 to 6 months because they didn't know what they were doing. And everybody thought, oh, I can do that. And a lot of people
but the industry keeps changing. So, so as everybody's offering this new service, that new service, you're not gonna keep up if you don't start offering that too.
Unless we believe it's a scam service that we are not going to offer our authors. You know, if you just look at some of the websites.
We will touch on that a little bit down the way as well.
Okay.
But I mean, basically, you weren't able to just sit and keep doing the same thing and over and succeed. You had to grow and you had to evolve.
And anybody in the online industry, any online industry, has to keep up with everything, or you go down.
And you were raising kids, and you had two more kids.
Did.
So now you're raising.
I got five kids.
You're raising five kids.
Uh huh.
And that wasn't enough for you.
I had to take in a couple strays.
You took,
yeah.
There were kids. Well, tell me about that. You took in strays.
I took in strays. That's how my kids. That's how my biological kids word it. Mainly Frank. There was a boy who was having problems at home, and he moved in with us. And he ended up attending a very large university and has a very successful job. And another boy was having problems at home, and he moved in with us for a while. Mm-hmm. I think he's a chef now. I have not talked to him in a while. But yeah, we took in not just stray animals, we took in stray people, and we were happy to do it. Yeah. And by this time, we're living in this house in Maine. It was not expensive at all. It was built in 1896. It was on a river. Tons of bedrooms to fill people with. Mm-hmm. You know, those people back then, the Catholics, Roman Catholics back then, they had a lot of kids. It was a huge house.
At some point, there were some problems with Amazon.
We received a message from Amazon. They wanted to talk to us on the phone. They told us, and by the way, we had thousands of books for sale on Amazon at this point. This is back in 2006.
Okay. And just so people understand, you, the publisher, finish publishing a book, mm-hmm. get it to the printer, it's all ready to go. So it basically automatically uploads the printer uploads it to Amazon, if I'm correct.
No.
Okay.
The printer is owned by the distributor.
I'm sorry, the distributor.
The distributor has an automated feed that goes out to thousands of retailers, including Amazon.
Including Amazon.
They do not upload the files to Amazon. I would not let them do that.
Yeah.
But Amazon picks up the feed and our books, I mean, within hours of an author approving their print galley, which is the first bound printed copy of their book, pops up on Amazon. So our books are all over Amazon at this point. This is 2006.
So at this point, in 2006, I go on Amazon. I say, oh, I want to buy a copy of this book. I click on that. That basically sends a signal through Amazon to the distributor / printer. Mm-hmm. They print the book, mail it to you.
Right. And they even use an Amazon.com address
label. That was the structure at that point.
Right.
So then Amazon contacts you and says what?
They tell me, you need to start paying us to print your books, or we're going to take your books off our website.
And you already had your own printer. You didn't need Amazon.
Also, Amazon did own a company back then that was doing what we do. But there were so many complaints about the company online, quality, customer service. We ordered copies of the books that we ended up taking to court, and they were just awful.
Yeah.
Awful. At that time, we were in Maine. Amazon was in, I think, Seattle. The people that contacted us were in Seattle. We could not legally record the conversation. I set up that phone call.
Uh-huh.
However, dragged all my employees to a table. We all had our laptops open. I put the guy on speaker. We all typed what we heard.
Mm-hmm.
So they could never come back and say, oh, we never said that. I wrote about it on, you know, I told the guy, oh, we'll get back with you.
What?
You know?
Okay. Okay, I'm sorry. Go
so
ahead.
So he basically calls us and it's the same thing, you know.
So you have to print through, basically you have to abandon your printer and print with Amazon,
right.
Otherwise they're going to take all your books off Amazon, and that's a death sentence.
Yeah, that would have killed us. That would have killed our company. Okay. He specifically said you have to pay us to print your books. So I wrote about it on Writers Weekly to drum up support for us and to get the word out, because it wasn't just us they were doing this to, they were doing it to all of our competitors. Unfortunately, many of our competitors fell for the threat, signed Amazon's contract, and they're still stuck with it.
Mm-hmm.
They're still stuck with that deal. I wrote about it on Writers Weekly, and I was contacted by the Wall Street Journal. And they said, we'd like to interview you about this.
Mm-hmm.
So we did the interview, and we were RVing at the time, and I got a phone call from a guy, and he said, hey, I read about you in the Writers on the Wall Street Journal. I think you've got a case against Amazon, federal antitrust violations and violations of the Sherman Act. And I'm like, what? and he said, I work for a class action law firm, and we'd like to represent you. So I'm sorry, that was like an email. And then we had a phone conversation. His name was Seth, super nice guy. And for 2 years, we were embroiled in that.
And you tried to get other publishers to join you in this lawsuit.
Unfortunately, it was too late.
To
for
be
them.
a class action, lots of them folded. They wouldn't go with that, or they wouldn't,
lot of
they
them
wouldn't
had,
join you.
That had they were too afraid of Amazon. But my attitude was, if I'm going to go down, I'm going to go down doing it the right way, and I'm going to go down fighting. So, and if I go out of business because of this, I'm going to go out of business, because if I let Amazon try to do this to us or do this to us, I will never be able to look at myself in the mirror again and knowing that I just caved and let it go.
So mom with her five kids and this little publishing company stands up alone against the biggest bookseller, and then they were becoming the retailer. I don't know the exact timeline then, but yeah, they started out being the biggest bookseller, and then they were moving on to the they were already a behemoth at that point.
Right. Yeah.
And you stood up against them alone. And
I'm like,
I
talked on the phone with several of our competitors at the time, and nobody wanted to put anything in writing. And all of them were like, Angela, we just can't fight them. We're just afraid what's going to happen.
No.
We don't go out of business. I'm like, I don't care if they put me out of business. I'm doing it. And I did it.
And what was the result?
Well, 2 years of lost sleep, truly discovered behind closed doors, you know, with all the lawyer filings and the conversation, everything, back at that time, at least, what a jerk Amazon is.
Yeah.
You know, they threatened to counter sue us for what, you know, a lot of intimidation, you know? So we go to court.
Yeah.
Our lawyers, we were able to sue them in federal court in Bangor, Maine, because Amazon had warehouses and stuff all over the place. So I think they originally said that wrong jurisdiction, but the judge said, no, it's not. So I went to court, and of course, my husband at the time was with me, went to court, and our lawyers flew in. Amazon's lawyers were there. I wasn't really nervous.
Okay.
I expected that I would have been terrified, but I was so angry at how everything had been going. And this was, it was either going to get thrown out or the judge was going to say, go to discovery. Well, Amazon was actually going to charge us more money to print the books. And I took the three sample books there and showed the judge, look how crappy these look. One of them had pictures inside. They were almost all black.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you couldn't even discern what the pictures were on. And the judge said something like, well, I never read anything in your filings that they were going to charge you more money. I should have known that before now. And I went, oh, sorry, we're going to left that out. Anyway, the judge said, nope, he wouldn't dismiss the suit. And he said, proceed to discovery. And it wasn't long after that. One of our kids did a after school thing, and I was there, and my phone rang, and I went outside on the sidewalk, and it was Seth. He said, they want to settle for $300,000. And I literally started jumping up and down on the sidewalk because the nightmare was over. I want to add that we got not one dime. All the money went to the lawyers, and I did that on purpose. I never wanted anybody to think that we were suing Amazon to make a buck. We did it because it was the right thing to do. This is David and Goliath, is how it was often referred to by the media. And we won. I wasn't jumping up and down about the $300,000. I'm like, oh, I can finally sleep tonight. I was seething with rage some nights after reading some of their filings. Just, anyway.
Well,
it's over.
Lawfare is ugly, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So,
they also, part of the settlement was they were not allowed to mess with our books on their website.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you seriously dodged a bullet there, because like, again, if they took your books off Amazon, you would have been done. There was no
recovery. They would have put us out of business for sure.
So you mentioned at some point RVing, mm-hmm. and well, it wasn't like let's get in the RV and go somewhere. It was let's give up everything and get in the RV and travel the country and raise our kids in an RV. So tell me about that.
In middle school, our daughter was being bullied and we had to move her to a private school. Things were starting to change in Bangor, Maine at the time, the politics and everything. I won't get into that. But and we had the two youngest boys, of course. And we decided one day, hey, let's check out homeschooling. How hard can it be? So our daughter was in private school for 1 year. She loved it. But she and all except our oldest son, we were going to hit the road with all of them. Our oldest was like a senior in high school. And bought an RV. We bought this like satellite dish thing for internet in case we were somewhere that didn't have Wi-Fi. By the way, back then,
that stuff was expensive.
And not back then. I have a picture of me somewhere sitting at a campground in a folding chair, and I actually have my computer plugged into a payphone. There was a special plug where you could plug it into a payphone
and do dial up. Wow.
Yeah. That's somewhere. I'm also eating a banana at the same time. That was weird. We actually started a website back then, no longer needed, that told people which campgrounds had Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm.
Very few did. And that website did very well for a while. Now they all have it. So we took the website down like, I don't know, 15 years ago or something.
But again,
there
you are. You see a need. You mm-hmm. see a void in
industry.
In an industry, I guess. Yeah. Where people needed information.
Mm-hmm.
And you grabbed that opportunity. And you did it to be able, you know, to, well, get ahead.
Plastered ads for Book Locker and Writers Weekly all over that website.
Yeah.
And the first RV we owned, we actually had, the website was wirelesstrips.com. Again, no longer needed. It doesn't work anymore. But we were using that on the road to generate interest for our publishing company. We paid a company it's this funny picture. It's an RV and it's, our heads are poking out of the windows, but they're like abnormally large. And it's us and the kids, right? So the side of the RV was just this flat part. And we had this gigantic sticker thing of that picture put on the side, on both sides. And we go to campgrounds and people ask us about it. Over time, sometimes people would honk at us on the road. And then sometimes we meet people at campgrounds and say, I've been to your website. That was really cool.
That is cool.
But it was basically didn't take much effort at all. We'd find a website. Richard would, put it on the website. Campground that had Wi-Fi. Richard would put it on the site. Generated a lot of publicity for us over the years. So, and it was a lot of fun. So,
all right. So, let's move on to things that you've done to help the writing community. Because again, this was, some of this was about making money because you needed to feed your kids. But a lot of this, I mean, I've just seen this in you from when I first met you, is that a lot of the things you do, you're always thinking of other people when you're doing them. So again, you started out in Writers Weekly talking about basically unethical practices in some of the publishing companies, but mm-hmm. that has now moved on to going after big time real scammers, people that are just taking people's money and disappearing.
They're we're calling it the International Publishing Crime Cartel. It's, I think, three or four core companies, could be fewer, that are selling fake publishing services, printing services, fake anything you can think of that you need as an author for your book. They're selling it. And they're not some magazine that didn't pay a writer $100 last month. They're somebody who helped a woman get $5,000 back yesterday. Because she used her credit card. They are hoodwinking authors to tune of, you know, tens of thousands, some of them over 100,000. One guy spent over $1 million for a fake movie deal. And they're not located in the United States. They're in Pakistan, the Philippines, India. And went from getting nasty emails from magazine publishers who just didn't want to pay their bills to getting death threats from guys in Pakistan.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's really evolved.
Yeah. Yeah. And literally, I find myself thinking, I am too old for this crap.
I'm not.
I got to worry about, you know, Pakistani hitmen.
Wait, can I tell this story about the guy who came to the yard?
Tell whatever you want. Go ahead. Do I get to tell what you did in response to that? Or go ahead.
So the dogs are out front. They're going nuts. You were fishing.
Yeah, I was out fishing.
Yeah. This guy is in the yard. I think it's the mailman because I have my glasses on. He's got like the placard on the side of his car. I think it's
wearing an orange vest.
Wearing an orange vest, whatever. And anyway, I go outside to tank down. Tank, stop jumping on him. The guy's got like dog treats, and our mailman has dog treats. Anyway, he's like, oh, I deal with it all the time. I walk up to him. He finally comes into focus because, again, I don't have my glasses on. It's not the mailman.
Mm-hmm.
And then I look at his name tag, and I couldn't pronounce it for the life of me. And I looked at his face, and he talked to me, and I could kind of understand what he was saying. And then he said, I'm not even going to try to attempt the accent. Are you Angela? And I said, yep. And for just a split second, I thought, they found me. I mean, mm-hmm. seriously.
Yeah.
Thought they found me. No, it was a guy from Georgia Power, came to switch out our meter. But... So,
well,
go ahead.
He identified himself as being from Georgia Power to come
really
change out the meter.
Him.
So you went inside and left the front door unlocked,
mm-hmm.
the downstairs door unlocked, the garage open, after just thinking you might have just about encountered a hit.
I was hiding in the bathroom with my gun. Yeah, yeah. Well, I
had to give you a little hell for that one.
To be fair, when I walked inside, he said the power go off for a second.
Okay.
And I could hear the meters like off the bedroom wall outside. Mm-hmm. I could hear something going on, and then the power went off for like 3 seconds, came back on. I'm like, oh, he really does work for Georgia Power.
Thank God he wasn't just planting a bomb on the side of our house.
Well, that has to cross my mind.
So in the future, when the strange people show up and claim to be from the power company, you'll say thank you. Yes, go do what you do. And then you're going to lock yourself
well,
in the house.
Next time I'm not going to walk outside. I'll just let Tank eat him.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
The Amazon lawsuit, that you know, that helped far more people than just you, because it got Amazon to stop trying to force people into that.
I got a personal phone call from the head of Ingram Book Company, which is the world's largest book distributor. And I think he's deceased now, but he called me on the phone to thank me on behalf of the entire industry. And that was nice.
That's pretty good.
And I got a lot of emails and phone calls from even our competitors
mm-hmm.
that, you know, that were very thankful that for what we did.
You've created Writers Weekly Marketplace, which helps showcase freelance, I guess, services.
Yeah.
Editors, illustrators. Mm-hmm. Web design people, I think we have some of those on there. Just all kinds of people who we vet them. We make sure that, and if they don't live up to our standards after we put them on there, we take them off there. But
So you're helping other freelancers, professionals get work.
Yeah. Marketplace.writersweekly.com. You can see all the different categories. The two most popular ones are editors and illustrators. All the editors are native English speakers. They've been vetted by us. They've edited numerous books. They have a fantastic reputation. The illustrators do not use AI. These are true artists.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You started the short story contest. We talked about that in our last episode.
Right,
but that
so episode 9, if you want to hear how that started, that's 24hoursshortstorycontest.com.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
that was just for fun.
You created, under the umbrella of Writers Weekly, you also created another company called Buzz Press,
mm-hmm.
which allows people, well, tell me about what a Buzz Press does.
A BuzzPress.com is a hybrid publisher. Now, that is a very abused term in the industry. If anyone calls themselves a hybrid publisher, they're going to try to trick you into believing that you pay them so much money, they're going to match it to get your book published. That is BS. True hybrid publisher is a Buzz Press. We don't charge anything, authors anything up front. We're extremely selective about what we publish through that imprint. We publish maybe 10 to 12 books a year. It's really hard to get a contract through there. However, we don't charge authors anything. It's a 3-year exclusive contract and pays higher royalties than traditional publishers. That's why we call it a hybrid. Then everybody else started calling themselves hybrids and everybody's ruined it. So anyway.
And in response to the problems that you were seeing on Facebook writers groups and mm-hmm. authors groups with all of these scammers coming in and hitting people up with, hey, private message me so that we, you know, we can talk about your book. And
so frustrating.
You have created your own authors group in Facebook mm-hmm. where if you want to get in to that group, you have to ask to join, and it is one of us mm-hmm. that will vet you and determine whether or not you are one of these overseas scammers.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody that hits anybody up for, you know, oh, I'm an editor, private message me, out they go.
Yep, one strike and you're out.
You don't get a second warning.
Yeah.
What's that called?
Authors Safe Harbor. We will put a link to it under this episode on writersweekly.com/podcast.
And you're making you're not making any money off mm-mm. that. And you're donating your time, like you have a bunch of that.
Yeah.
You and some of our other Writers Weekly folks, Booklocker folks, are donating their time to sit and monitor that thing and mm-hmm. Make sure that anybody that breaks the rules gets booted.
Yeah, you and I and Allie are mm-hmm. the moderators right now. It's so Authors Safe Harbor. Authors is plural. The apostrophe is after the S. But again, we'll put the link underneath. And it's actually growing very fast, and it's a lot of fun. We talk about all kinds of stuff, and nobody gets spammed. It's just a discussion. Yeah. It's like you're sitting in a room with a bunch of other authors, and we're all having a good time. Yep. And lots of questions getting answered, and advice, and nobody's getting scammed or spammed. So it's really doing well.
I'm going to skip down here to this heading that you put in. Looks like lawsuit threats. You want to talk about those?
Oh, yeah. These are funny.
Okay.
Yeah.
These, I guess we'd have to add this on the list of challenges for you. So you've been threatened in numerous ways.
Yeah. Not just my life.
Yeah. So talk about them.
I'm not going to name anybody, but because that's all I need is these people threaten to sue me again. We'll call this one the vexatious litigator. I've talked about him on another podcast. He was declared a vexatious litigator in California. He would sue people just to harass them, mm-hmm. and he would represent himself pro se. That's what it means, representing yourself in court, and just to harass people. Well, mm-hmm. he did it like 50 times in California, so they told him you can't file any more lawsuits. So he moved to Arizona and started all over again. We exposed a scam he was involved in. He was hiring writers to write chapters of books about universities. He would print a couple copies of each book, send it to the university, tell them, hey, order, you know, however many copies or whatever, charge them an arm and a leg for it. It was almost like a ghostwriting service,
textbooks,
you know?
Of course they charge an arm and a leg. Yes.
It's not a textbook.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's, okay, he would hire a bunch of writers to write chapters about a specific university.
Okay.
He would have the university pay him to offer this service, and then he would say he would tell them, I'm going to send copies of your book all over the country, mm-hmm. or whatever. I can't remember exactly how it worked. He wasn't paying his writers. That's what really made me mad. Mm. And then turned into a big scam. So we published about him on Writers Weekly, and he threatened to hire someone to, quote, take care of me, come to our house and, quote, take care of me. He threatened to pick up our kids from school. He was a wacko, total mm-hmm. wacko. Sued us, cost me $10,000. We won, was thrown out of court, and, of course, never collected the money. So, because, yeah. And then there was this her name was Martha.
You said you weren't going to collect the name.
I'm not going to give you her last name. Because I'm still scared of her. She threatened, we exposed her scam, and she was scamming writers. She emailed me, threatened to fly from New York to Maine to, quote, beat me up. Now, my last name is Hoy, and one of the emails, she called me Jap Mother You Know What. She was a piece of work.
And you're not Japanese, neither was...
Well, not that it matters. It's still offensive.
Your husband from... Yeah.
Right. Just... even if I was... I mean, it doesn't matter.
Well, exactly.
Matter. Just,
I'm just saying, just she clearly didn't do her homework and know who you were.
Level of blatant just... Wow. Yeah. I mean, how unprofessional can you get?
Well, and who says Jap nowadays? I mean,
that's true.
On.
So anyway, she did go to jail for her scams.
Well, good.
Yeah.
Good.
Mighty Words. Oh, we wrote a warning about Mighty Words, and I can't remember what the warning was. I'm not paying people or what. I can't remember. It was such a long time ago, but it doesn't matter because they're out of business. They had us served. Okay. Did you know that you can have registered mail delivered to somebody on Christmas Day?
Apparently, yes.
They had the mailman deliver a registered letter to us on Christmas morning while we're all opening Christmas presents, and it was a lawsuit threat. I know they did that on purpose. Mm-hmm. And then they went belly up anyway. So, yeah, snakes.
Why were they trying to sue you?
We published an article about complaints about them online.
I got you. Yeah. Okay.
Get those all the time. And then, of course, you know, now all the death threats.
Death threats just keep on coming.
Keeping on. Yep.
That's okay.
I don't know.
I'm not overly concerned.
I know, you know, when you've been doing this as long as we've been doing it, there's really nothing anybody can send that shocks me anymore.
Yeah.
You know, I'm just used to it. Yeah. And whatever. I'm packing.
Okay.
Bring it on.
So you added to our script. How'd you end up in Georgia?
Well, went from Texas to Massachusetts to Maine to Florida to another place in Florida to living on a boat in Florida. And then that was a lot of fun. And that's where I met Brian in Florida.
2016.
Yep. And we got tired of the hurricanes. Okay, I got tired of the hurricanes. Mason, our youngest especially got tired of hurricanes and tornadoes and stuff. Well, didn't get away from the tornadoes, but... during COVID, we sold the boat, moved into a townhouse for a year while we looked for a place to live. And a year later, we were living here, top of Sand Mountain. Yep. That's how we end up in Georgia.
And I'll have to give a shout out to a crazy ex-girlfriend. Thank you for
crazy Christine
leading me to meet up with Angie. Yeah.
Well, you're going to tell the story now.
Nope. Not going to. That's for another time. We'll tell that story another time.
Okay. All right.
Well, we're already at an hour and something here, depending on how much I edit this thing.
One thing I wanted to add was, where are our kids today?
Yep. This was all about them.
This was about taking care of my kids and making sure that they succeeded. And, so oldest is a property manager.
Mm-hmm.
Next one works for the company, is taking over the company someday. She has worked for us for years and years. Who's next? Frank is a dentist.
Mm-hmm.
Max is a welder.
A welder.
Yeah. And very good at what he does. And he's very successful at it. And Mason is 18 and he is working for the company now. He's making audio music. He makes original music out of
basically doing synthesized music. Yeah.
Okay. All
yeah.
right. He registers Library of Congress control numbers. He registers our copyrights now.
Does
he
creates trailers.
Book trailers. Yeah. Oh, And he's taking over our accounting. He's amazing at numbers. He's like this QuickBooks genius. And, he also probably spends 20 hours a week working on our scammer spreadsheet and helping us add scammers to the website.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a jack of all trades. I don't know, if he ever envisioned working for BookLocker and Writers Weekly forever, but he loves it. He especially loves tracking down the scammers and finding, that phone number is the same as that phone number and that same address as that one. And Facebook says they're in Pakistan. And so, he's really enjoying his job. And he's really, really good with authors. You would never know he's 18 if you're corresponding with him. Oh, he's almost 19.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And that's the story.
That's the story.
That's so... Folks, when you're looking for a publisher, you want to know who to do business with. There's lots of options out there. Well, now you know the whole background story of where BookLocker came from, and why it came to be, and who's behind it. And I think that's important to know that the motivations of the people running the company that you're dealing with.
And we're not in Pakistan.
We speak English, and we're not going to rip you off. So,
it's always been about integrity, because our reputation is our most valuable asset.
I will give one testimony here, and it won't be about Crazy Christine. in my 10 years with you, almost 10 years now, we have had our ups and downs with the business.
Sure.
I actually thought when I was putting the script together of asking you to go through the years and tell us presidential administrations, your income up, down.
Well,
and there's a pattern.
There is a pattern. Yeah, sure.
And we have hit some
things
very,
go up and down. Yeah.
Very difficult times. And
there have been times it ebbs and flows, and when it ebbs,
your biggest
you get
thing is not what are we going to do if things go bad. It's what about all my authors? Mm-hmm. What about all my employees? I have employees that are depending on me,
mm-hmm.
and I hear you do that time and again,
mm-hmm.
when we talk about the direction of this company and. So, your focus is always on the people depending on you, not, gosh, what's going to happen to me?
And I'm a bit of a, might call me a control freak. I don't know. I'm also a worrier.
Yeah.
And I worry about people. And so, for example, we have a month. Okay, January. Here's an example. Everybody buys books October through December.
Mm-hmm.
January book sales always drop. You know what I do every February 1st when I look at the January sales? I go,
freak out, man.
Yeah. I know. It's been, 26 year. We're in our 26th year. I know what's going to happen, but I'm so very cautious. And I run a very tight ship, and we've always paid our bills on time. Mm-hmm. The company is debt-free, mm-hmm. and has been for years. I don't know, over 20 years been debt-free. That's always been very important to me.
Yep.
I don't make a ton of money. I don't do this to, I never did this to get rich.
Yeah.
I did it to make the world a better place and to make authors, take care of authors and take care of writers and bring people together. But yeah, when we have a bad month, I worry far more about my authors, my employees, and we do have a few contractors than I do about me, because I can always get a job, making bonsai trees or something. I don't know.
Well, there you go. All right. Well, that went a little longer than I expected, but that's okay. Nobody seems to mind on the listening end. I don't know what parts of this I'm going to cut out, but anyway.
Hey, there's one of our authors wrote to me, and she said she listens to our podcast on the way home from work every day.
Our podcast is doing well. Again, I know there's millions and millions of podcasts out there, and some of them have, thousands of downloads every time they put out a new episode, but we're happy with where we're at.
It's
growing.
Yeah.
And I thank everybody out there, because it's because of you that we're growing. It's we put it out there, but if you're not downloading and listening, we don't go anywhere with this.
True.
With that, I would ask if you're listening on one of those, wherever you're listening, give us either a 5-star rating or hit the like button on YouTube or whatever you can to rate us. And you like what you listen to, give us a good rating, because that will help push our podcast deeper into the algorithm and lets more people find it, listen to it, all that kind of stuff.
Also, writersweekly.com/podcast. Please share it with your friends and your writing and author groups.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that's going to wrap it up for this week. Again, thanks for listening, and we will see you again next week on the Writers Weekly Podcast.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.